Well, hey there, everybody. Welcome to another week or half month of Cambridge Inside Out. I think our last pair of shows was December 17th or thereabouts. So we've had a holiday in between. We're in the midst of a presidential transition and a death of a former president, the very first president, Jimmy Carter, who I ever voted for. I was first eligible to vote in 1973, and but for a national election, my first one would have then been 1976. And I voted for Jimmy Carter in the primaries and in the general election. So there you have it. I think I was a New York resident back in those days. What's going on in town? I think I'm going to actually just sort of start by doing something, since one of the things that I don't know if I'm the, I'm certainly not the only one. I think a lot of magazines do it, newspapers, electronic media do it, is they sort of do a recount of some of the people, rather significant people who have passed away in the last, year or thereabouts. And I thought I would just mention it because, so much of the focus is on major figures in entertainment or in politics, or, you name it. But the thing is that, I have a kind of a much more Cambridge specific point of view. So I just sort of admit, I was just going through these. I actually, while I was at it, I actually said, I never did this in for the last few years, so let me just do it for the last few years. But so I just sort of noted that we began the year just sort of chronologically. Rachel Solom, who ran some of the bed and breakfasts, she was very active in the civic sense. She passed away in January 15th. Very much a friend of many, many of us. Louis Bacci, who was on the planning board, and I didn't know he had been sick for some time, but he passed away in January as well. I actually also like to include people like Mo Morris, who was people who I knew working for the city, as city workers working. I knew her originally from, when I spent a lot of time in public works when I was involved in recycling. There was Charles Fried, who was actually a member of the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts and a Harvard professor, passed away in January. A friend to many, many people, Paul Ryder, who was director of recreation programs for the city, passed away in February 26. They have since named, I think, the clubhouse up at the golf course in his honor. A really, really great guy. I list here also George Olson, only because I was made aware of the fact that he had served on the Cambridge School Committee at some point many years ago. Another real major figure, not only in Cambridge, but all sorts of places, was Janet Murray. One of the most generous people, kind of an icon of Cambridgeport, I would say. Dave Albert was with the Cambridge Police Department. Actually, the Alberts were, the family, or a lot, quite a few Alberts in the Cambridge Fire Department and the Police Department. Passed away. Somebody who many of us knew from long, long ago was Boomer Kennedy, used to run Chicago Auto. Was during the Women in Trades movement, which goes back a good long way. She had since moved away, I think, out to the Southwest. She may have been in someplace else when she passed away in June. Another person, Bob Latremoille, who was known by many of us as an activist for many, many, many years. Some in more recent years, people sort of, somewhat disparagingly called him the goose guy because he was so such an advocate for the white geese down near the Rio Bridge area. Len Solo, who I believe was a principal of Cambridge Ridge Latin High School for some years. Freddie Cabral, who we all knew from civic world, public works. Artist John Taguri, I remember working with him when we were working out the public area recycling bins and putting decals on them. A real big loss was City Councilor Joan Pickett, who died late August. An icon of the neighborhood of North Cambridge was Red McGrail on September 11th. And then Alan Steinert, who I knew through political activities, and he was very, very involved in getting. I think it was one of the charter schools going, the one that's located on Essex Street, the name of which is just escaping me at the moment. But I'll also mention that at the very end of the year, somebody who I never met, but who was somewhat renowned, was Robert Peterkin, who was the former Cambridge superintendent of schools, and there was I only knew that there was some controversy around the time in the mid 80s when he was chosen as school superintendent, because his predecessor was a gentleman named William Lannan, who was was a little bit controversial, in to say the least, in his role, not initially, but toward the end. Many have suggested, I think, that he was making political friends by providing the appropriate political patronage to the well-connected, which has always been a problem with the Cambridge school system, where the sort of the well-connected used to be people who were associated with the Cambridge Civic Association, used to make sure that the schools that their children went to were always lavished with support. And there was a real movement at the time to have a greater equity across all the schools, so that it wouldn't just be the sort of the very precious schools that would get all the support, but it would be done more uniformly and more fairly. And in a kind of an interesting twist on the usual assumption about the townies are the ones who are, the ones who are all gung-ho for patronage, and then the progressives are the ones who were going to get rid of patronage and provide equity. This was a complete opposite. This was really a case where the more CCA-connected people, the progressives were the one who were getting the patronage, and it was actually the people who were more of a townie sort who were basically saying enough of this. So it was somewhat controversial when it happened, but Lannan went, Peterkin came in, and he actually ushered in a very good period of time for the Cambridge Public Schools. I will mention here that it's sort of, I don't follow Cambridge schools so much, but there was an article in the Boston Globe just 2 days ago, sort of highlighting, basically the title was "Cambridge Tried to Get Better Racial and Economic Diversity Among Students. Now it has one of the most segregated schools in the state." I believe they're referring to the Fletcher Maynard Academy here, but and I'm not going to go through this whole article here. I'm just going to sort of come back here and just sort of say here that it just seems to me, again, as a bit of an outsider and who is not has no children and certainly doesn't have any children in the Cambridge public school system, that we are in this sort of constant cycle in the Cambridge schools where some big idea is implemented to somehow equalize all the schools and make everything all fair and square, like we call restructuring or what have you, or they fire a school superintendent, bring in another school superintendent. And then, it's sort of like when you change tax laws so to make them more equitable, then the people who know how to work it, give them a few years, they'll find a way to make it as inequitable again as possible. And I think that same thing happens with schools. So now we have some, I mean, it's really kind of a pretty cutting article in the Boston Globe about how we now have one of, in good old progressive Cambridge, we have one of the most segregated schools in the Commonwealth. And if you couple that with the fact that the school committee, for reasons I still don't fully understand, have decided to close the Kennedy Longfellow School down in East Cambridge, which honestly just makes no sense to me in terms of just geographic distribution of school buildings and school resources. But when you've got an entire system that is sort of built like a house of cards on various control choice programs and other programs to try and socially engineer things and get equity in whatever, however you choose to define it across the schools, inevitably it's kind of works a little like economics. Inevitably you end up with a lot of deadweight loss in the process, and all the things you dreamed about is just not what you get. And I think I made some comment to somebody the other day, or maybe it was actually in the Boston Globe article, that I said, I wonder what would actually happen in Cambridge if you just got rid of all of that stuff completely and just had neighborhood schools. Would it be worse? Or might it even be better? Somehow it seems to me that if you actually had a little sort of neighborhood cohesion, people rally around, my school, be true to your school, as the Beach Boys once sang, that you might actually end up with a better system. You might have a little bit of racial disparity, a little bit of economic disparity, but you're getting that now anyway. So why do we put so much effort into propping up a system that is inevitably going to be imperfect at best and dreadful at worst, you know. So I know that's probably a controversial point of view to sort of say, let's, can we just throw it all out and just basically tell people to just go to the school closest to you? But you know, that's, it's not a crazy idea. And there are even people in Boston, you know, which was the site of, you know, big bus, school busing battles, where some of the people in some of the more heavy minority areas were actually advocating for neighborhood schools, which is kind of an interesting twist 40 years later, you know. But anyway, so all of these thoughts came rolling to me here when, you know, with the passing of Robert Peterkin, you know, who was arguably a person who was successfully getting better distribution of resources and greater fairness in the Cambridge public schools, you know, during the from about, I think, 1984 or five until about maybe 1989, where he was called away to do similar good work in places. I think it was in, what was it, in Milwaukee or you know, someplace else like that, and then eventually came back and worked. You know, it was a really great resource for schools and school superintendents back here in Massachusetts, I think with some Harvard affiliation eventually. So anyway, so those are some very significant passings. You know, one thing that occurs to me in a kind of a tangential way is that you know, we don't actually have a local newspaper anymore. And you know, you can pretend like as if Cambridge Day is that, but honestly, it's primarily just defamation and anonymous comments as far as I'm concerned. But the one of the principal roles of something like a paper of record is that you have things like obituaries and articles about significant passings of people, and we just don't get that. I mean, sometimes we're fortunate enough if somebody was significant enough that somebody like Brian Markhart for the Boston Globe will write a, he writes some of the best obituaries in the business, quite honestly. And so sometimes we'll be treated to a really nice write-up from somebody like Brian Markhart, but you know, we don't have it. You know, so in my own silly little way, I'm sort of trying to at least highlight some of the notable passings of people who are not just national figures, but you know, just, you know, local people of some significance. And I always feel just a little guilty whenever I say anything like that, because, you know, whenever anybody passes away, it's significant to some people, you know. You know, but so what, you know, the act of picking and choosing people to be called, those are the significant ones. It's a little nasty in a way, you know, but you know, you do what you can, you know. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. So let me say a few things about what's happening on the civic front here. I have not been going up to city council meetings. I don't particularly feel welcome there anymore because of some of the hostility expressed by some of our city councilors, you know, who would make judgment based on rumor and innuendo rather than on fact and understanding. And thought and consideration, you know. But you know, we got what we got. All right. Anyway, but they do meet. They still do meet apparently, and I do at least occasionally check it out on TV. And I, you know, and I feel some duty to sort of write up some, you know, previews and summaries of significant things that happen at these meetings. So let me just say a few things about, for starters, just about last night's city council meeting. You know, again, I kind of wish I was sort of maybe going to some of the school committee meetings, but that doesn't really work out with my schedule very well. So last night, you know, it was, again, the first regular meeting of the new year, January 6th meeting. There were a few matters of some significance. Maybe I'll just to sort of pop over here to speak about it just a little bit here. Pardon me while I jump around a little bit. Here we go. You know, so now actually, let me just say before I get into some of the particulars that, you know, I was just sort of feeling my oats a little bit, and you know, somehow it was, yes, I was paying attention to what was on the agenda, but you know, something is I've been thinking about for some time actually goes beyond any particular agenda item. It's sort of a general pattern that we've been, I think we've been seeing with St. Cambridge political activity and, you know, civics of late, you know, in this sort of age of sort of this sort of a local version of the hyper-partisanship that we see sometimes at the national level. You know, there's a meanness, there's an absolute meanness about it, but Whether it's the sort of the build, 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 higher, deeper, thicker, denser kind of crowd, which is personified, if you want to use the word personified, by a better, so-called a better Cambridge, or more appropriately called a bigger Cambridge, who will dismiss anybody who disagrees with them or even questions them as you're just an evil NIMBY, and they will hand you a copy of the book Neighborhood Defenders just to prove in their little minds what an evil person you are because you objected to the fact that somebody wanted to put a six-story building up next to your single-family home on a street that has never seen taller buildings. And if you object, you're evil, and that's that, right? But what the city council and even some of the advice of I don't want to say the planning board, but I'll say some of the people within the community development department, they seem to feel that real public involvement, where you have a say, maybe you can affect the outcome of a proposal, that this is anathema to sort of, do-goodism in the current mindset. And you're just an evil NIMBY, and NIMBYs just block projects. They file lawsuits, they delay projects, they cause costs to go up, and then in the end, don't you know, the world just falls apart as a result. Well, listen, I'll be the first to admit and agree that there have been some real mean characters who have blocked projects over the years. But I can also point to many a project and some developers who will frankly say that the public input was actually really helpful for them, and it helped them make a better project. It helped them maybe scale something down, but make for better relations with neighbors, so that in the end you could actually get near unanimous approval of something that might otherwise have been considered a threat to somebody, So it's just been a thought that's been running through my head a lot lately about how we have been slowly but surely pushing away public involvement. Public feedback really is unwelcome. If you think about it, even in the context of the, actually, I'm going to sort of step away from this here a little bit. Even in the context of when the affordable housing overlay was being the 1.0, as they call it, and AHO 2.0, the sort of the other than the fact that it was primarily about making sure that Cambridge Housing Authority and Justice Start could build denser on properties they already owned, in spite of the fact that it was sold as somehow miraculously going to cause there to be affordable housing uniformly spread around the city, never happened, probably won't happen. In addition to basically allowing those properties to densify, the other real major figure or piece about this was to make everything not only as of right, but not even subject to any kind of approval process. I mean, for better or worse, I always thought that Cambridge's penchant for having special permit processes was actually a pretty good thing because, it basically said, look, if you want to build something, you can build something okay as of right. But if you want to build something a little bigger or better, then you just have to come to us. And as long as you meet specific criteria, you will get your special permit, and then you can build what you want. And 95, actually probably 99% of all special permits have been granted. It gave there a little bit of leverage to the planning board to actually get better outcomes based on, design criteria, compatibility with abutters, you name it, right? But the current mindset with and it runs right through the damn city council. But you also see it within the community development department. It basically says no go. We don't with the AHO, the planning board is as I've put it, I said they've been reduced to a role of spectators. So basically the Affordable Housing Trust, which is unelected, thank you very much, democracy. We'll say we want to build this housing here. We don't want anybody to raise any objections, and we don't even want the planning board to raise any issues. Or if they want to raise issues, we'll take it under advisement and then do nothing. And that's kind of been the way of things. Currently there's a big proposal right now, all under the disguise as eliminating no encouraging no or permitting multifamily housing in all residential zones of the city, Or sometimes other people, like the ABC people, will call it ending exclusionary zoning, right? Always sort of to spin it in such a way that somehow you're doing the Lord's work. The truth of the matter is that I haven't heard I have heard barely any objections to by anyone regarding allowing multifamily residential properties, even in areas which, like the Resident A's districts or Resident B's districts, which are primarily single family and two family. It seems like most people are pretty okay with having multifamily housing, but so the real issue isn't that. So why are we even calling this the MFH petition, multifamily housing petition? Because it's not about multifamily housing. It's about dramatically increased density and heights on streets which are just don't have any of that, some people like Paul Toner, I think Anisha Wilson, were saying, well, maybe we should just concentrate that in the squares and on the corridors, though nobody wants to define corridor. And that would be at least a little bit consistent with the Envision Cambridge ideas, which was about focusing on squares and corridors for increased heights and densities, as opposed to just invading every single residential street and saying, "Nah, nah, 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 you've got too much money. We don't like you. The people are taking over, and we're going to put up a six-story building next year." Next year place here. And oh, not only that, we also going to make sure that they can build as close to the lot line as is humanly possible. I think there is a proposed amendment right now to scale it back to allow at least a little bit, maybe enough room that you can pull the garbage cans out from the back of the house, but barely more than that. I think even where I live, you're supposed to have a 20-foot setback at the rear of the property, and that would be considered excessive right now under what's being proposed. So the real heart of this proposal is about dramatic increase in heights, dramatic increase in density. They scaled it down for the original was going to be something like 80 foot or six, I don't know, what is it, six story plus. And then now they're talking, then they say, well, all right, we'll make it now, just because there was a lot of public outcry. They'll say, well, we'll make it so that it's six stories, but you got to be, you can go to four, right? Right now, 35-foot height limits restricts it to about three in a lot of places, which, again, if you listen to Dennis Carlone, who knows a thing or two about urban design, that's a sweet spot for what you might call human scale development. But okay, fine. You want to go to four, great. But they say, if you want to do that, then you go to six, and you got to provide two inclusionary housing units, so that basically you're just going to contribute them, so that Chris Cotter over at Community Development Department, or I guess he's now the head of the housing division, he can decide who gets to live there, not you. And I look at that and I go, that seems a little silly. I mean, if I could build three or four, without restriction, or if I could go to six, but then I have to make the city give complete control over two of them, I would never build the six. I would just stick with the whatever I could build without that level of city involvement. So I don't know what these city councilors are thinking. I certainly don't know what people in community development are thinking. It just seems to me that they swallowed a pill one day that said that, don't you know, for the sake of equity and inclusion and whatever, we have to do something. And even if we have no idea what we're doing, we're going to do something anyway. And so I just think this is like a runaway train. But the problem is, it may very well have five votes because of the way the politics work. And I can tell you, as a person who's probably seen as the biggest proponent of proportional representation elections, I'm starting to wonder about proportional representation elections, because of the way you get these narrow constituencies electing a person there who does not representative in particular ways. And I'm ready to raise some issues, and there are some people, and that's another issue about charter change, because that's sort of right on the it's right on the stovetop right now. Being cooked up almost as we speak, but I'll talk about that in a bit here. So anyway, a few other things. Oh yeah, by the way, with that multifamily housing thing, so they got the planning board report. They referred it to the petition. There are a few amendments to make it at least a little bit more reasonable. But again, this is all part of that strategy, which is you propose something insane, scale it back somewhat, and then call it a compromise, which to me is a totally dishonest way to do business. Also some other things that happened at the meeting last night. Actually, there's $2.5 million allocation to assist Neville Center, which is, I guess that's the assisted living facility, or the, I always get confused. There's the assisted living, and then there's the nursing care, which is up on the Fresh Pond Reservation. But there's aging infrastructure in the building, unfavorable loan arrangements. They want to extend the loan out for a number of years, get better rates so that they can cut their monthly costs down from, I think, like 100-something thousand down to 75,000 to enable them to operate more efficiently. So now that matter was made subject to the charter right by Councillor Nolan. I'm a little unsure about that. Because of the fact that there's financing done through Rockland Trust, which is a private entity, that somehow public funds shouldn't go toward that. But hey, every time we fund anything, isn't that, there's money being leveraged and money being borrowed. So, where's it all coming from? So is it all government funds? I don't think so. Even when we borrow money, we float bonds, and in order to cover long range projects, it's not like we're just using city money. It's coming from somewhere. So anyway, so that's coming here. There was also, they passed a home rule petition for to create a job. This is to ask the state legislature for authorization to create a job training trust. This is sort of related to the linkage payments, the incentive zoning, so that they jacked it up to like $33 on the thousand, I guess, for new development, commercial development to go to the Affordable Housing Trust. They said, well, another sort of good outcome would be to do job creation, but nobody bothered to really check and say, well, aren't we doing a lot of that already? Do we really need to create this new entity? So there were two councillors who didn't vote in support of this, councillors Toner and Zusi, because they said we should really evaluate what we're doing first. But we still have seven councillors who say let's go for it anyway, and we'll no doubt end up funding it here whether we need it or not, because we love to fund stuff here. We're Cambridge, don't you know? There was another thing, this was sort of floating around on unfinished business for a while, which was amendments to the cycling safety ordinance. Now, that, don't get too excited about it, but for that, this was the idea was that there had been some delays so they could reevaluate some things and make a few amendments to accommodate some parking in some ways, which may make sense along North Mass Ave, but probably don't make much sense in a lot of other places. So anyway, they passed those. It was interesting because you had person after person after person during public comment come up there, basically saying, yes, please pass this as it's stated and be done with it. And they continued to quote the fact that there were three fatalities of people on bicycles over this past year, and as rationale for why we have to get more separated bike lanes. They failed to mention that all three of those fatalities were of bicyclists who were on separated facilities. Two of them were on roadways that had been separated, with the pylons, the flex posts, with separate bike signals and all of those things here. So the real issue is not whether you needed separated bike lanes. You need good separated bike lanes or bad separated bike lanes. And apparently these two were not so great because people were still killed at intersections, because the issue has always been intersections. The other gentleman who passed away was out on the Paul Dudley White bike path, which has been a separated path for since before I moved to Cambridge 46 and a half years ago. It's just that there were a few places near intersections or places where there were a couple little dodgy spots. It was at the dodgy spots. So it wasn't like there wasn't already a separated facility. There was. And now the state has come in, thankfully, and they're making corrections to fix that here. But it's amazing when the advocacy is for we must create separated bicycle infrastructure. When you start quoting fatalities as your rationale, when in fact all of them have occurred at separate facilities, that I just say, is this real? This is like thoroughly disingenuous. So anyway, I'm going to say another thing about bikes in a second, but I'm going to just take my little artificial pause here, and then I'll come back in seconds for Cambridge Inside Out.